Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rutt. Today I have the floor. I am talking to the three writers that we're featuring. Two old friends, both poets, Bernadette Hall and James Norcliffe, have new books. Bernadette has a children's book that she's done in collaboration with artist Catherine Medill. James Norcliffe has just turned 80, and there has been a collection of his poetry just published, a celebration of all the work that he's done over the years. And I'm also talking with Elizabeth Knox about her memoir entitled Nightmare. It's had an extraordinary effect on people who have read it. And I'm really looking forward to talking to her about what this has meant to her and her family to go through three quite tumultuous years of their lives together. For the first time, Canterbury book lovers can join fellow readers worldwide in the Global Book Crawl. It's a growing movement and it's taking place from the 20th to the 26th of April. Canterbury's independent bookstores have joined colleagues from Reykjavik in Ireland to Chihuahua in Mexico in organising this Global Book Crawl. Readers are invited to collect a free passport from any collaborating Canterbury bookshops. Now, look, I'll start again. Readers are invited to collect a free passport from any collaborating Canterbury bookstores and visit them, taking part at any time during the week. You can collect a free passport from any of the collaborating Canterbury bookshops, visit the stores, collect a stamp, and then once completed, hand the passport in to any of these bookshops before 5 p.m. on Sunday the 26th of April to be in the draw to win $250 of book tokens.
Once upon a time, there was a girl called Sol. She lived with her mother and her father and her brother in a cottage by the sea. She was born on a Sunday, so she was a child of grace, with a disposition that all agreed was sunny. But there came a time when she was in her 16th year that she fell into a terrible silence. It was as if her heart had filled with ice, the toughest, most lovely metamorphosis of water. She remained like this, day after day, month after month. No one could help her. No one could get her to speak. Then, one night in winter, she heard somebody calling her name. She got out of bed. She wrapped a shawl around her shoulders. It had been left to her by her grandmother. She crept past the room where her parents were sleeping, and the room where her brother was sleeping. She opened the door of the cottage quietly, and she closed it quietly behind her. Then out she went, through the garden, through the forest, and down onto the beach.
That was Bernadette Hall reading from the quite extraordinary collaboration that she and artist Catherine Medill have done. The book is called The Girl Who Was Swallowed by Ice and Snow. Bernie, of course, much loved and highly respected poet. She's a teacher, mentor, writer of nonfiction, and now, of course, a writer of gothic fiction. She was awarded the Prime Minister's Award for Poetry in 2015. She is a member of the New Zealand, I never quite know what it is, MNZM. Yes, exactly. She's had many fellowships and awards and you know, gone to places like Hobart, New York, Iowa and Ireland. And, of course, with Aussie-Porty artist Catherine Medill, went to Antarctica in 2004. They shared a residency down there. And this is where this remarkable piece of work originated. Bernie, tell us about that, because it's been a long genesis, hasn't it?
Well, clearly, yes, 2004. It's a long, long, long story, my story with Catherine Medill. It turns out now that when I started high school teaching at Otago Girls High School, she was actually in the sixth form. I was teaching the seventh form. So that wasn't yesterday. That was a very, very long time.
No.
Probably about 68, 69. A friend said to me, it may be approaching 1980, 90, you must go down to Oamaru and see an artist whose work is there in the Forrester Gallery because she paints what you write. And I went down, I walked into the Forrester Gallery and I was just blown away because there were the miniaturist images which absolutely just matched the way my imagination works, the way my writing kind of works as well. And I said, could I go and meet her? And the man said, no. She's very quiet. She hasn't.
She's very private, isn't she?
Yes. I said, could you give me her address? No, I can't do that either. And I said, well, if I give you a letter, could you please pass it on? And he did, and we met. And then I realised I taught with her at Moreau College for a year, but she had a different name at that stage. But this is all just to say that for someone who said they would never travel, when I said to her, would you like to go to Antarctica? Yes, straight off, straight off. So we applied in 2002, would be then going at the end of 2003, and we failed because we really didn't have a solid, solid worked out scheme. And I don't work with schemes, and I'm sure she doesn't work with schemes either. So a lovely woman, Natalie Cadenhead, who was on the board of Antarctica New Zealand, she was our guide and she said, look, girls, you've just got to make a plan. And I just fished out something out of the air. So really a bit of a fraud. I said, I'd been in Ireland for some time and I thought, well, Gothic, ghosts, things, all sorts of things like that. I'll write a Gothic novella and Catherine will illustrate it.
And I have to say, because I used to be a Medill, that they are Irish. And Catherine had probably at that stage done that remarkable series of paintings depicting people in the famine, ghostly figures, mythical, mystical figures across, moving across a, you know, strange, haunting landscape. So perfect.
It was absolutely perfect. Perfect. And yeah. I mean, I was born in central Otago, but I grew up in Dunedin. So all her coastal paintings and the paintings of, you know, Orpheus and Eurydice, we actually bought that one. That's one that I treasure. I just love this mixture of myth and inspiration and very, very deep kind of, they're sexy at the same time. You know, they're very spiritual.
Yes.
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful things.
Yeah. So the pair of you in Antarctica, you know, can you explain, you know, briefly what that was like for you? Because it's, you know, your work has gone on to use all that inspiration and exhilaration for being in that landscape.
It was a key turning point for both of us. When each of us, when we both came back, you know, our lives changed dramatically. I was standing on Observation Hill when I turned 59 and I thought up there, I'm not going back teaching. And I stopped then. And Catherine made another life-changing decision. She came back and she put hers into operation as well. But it was an extraordinary experience because part of it was like being in a scout camp with all the crazy guys around, you know, and the great hilarity at the dinner tables and that kind of thing going on. When I first entered the kitchen, "Oh, you write poetry," they said. "Yes. Well, Jeff the chef, he writes poetry." And I walked over to the fridge where the little metal letters on the fridge was a poem that was so hot that it could have melted the Antarctic ice. Talk about, you know, love starved or whatever. Yes. And, of course, everybody laughed. So there was that kind of adventure. Then there was the physical thing because we were not sitting in a library. We were out the whole time. I think it might have been the last time that happened. We had to learn how to build a snow cave. We had to carry all our own gear. We camped in one of the dry valleys. We were taken in by helicopter. We were always with our guides and with the David Truebridge, who was a part of our group. So the whole thing, I think, really just set aside our normal way of living. And it was extraordinary. And at the same time, it was extraordinarily, extraordinarily enchanting and beautiful and extremely dangerous. So all the time we were being trained, you know, you have to look out for yourself. You have to follow the rules. If you leave the base, Scott Base, and you don't sign in when you come in, all hell will break loose. We'll be out looking for you. So as a school teacher, I had to learn to become obedient, which was one of the things that I found there. But I could just quickly read maybe this poem, which is called Under Erebus. And it kind of applies to me and to Catherine because we walked around really as twin souls. And if we saw a grotto with icicles hanging in it or anything, we wouldn't talk. We would just look and we'd know that each of us was looking at it. And because we were with David Truebridge, the photographer, he would take years setting up tripods and this and that and whatever. And we would just sit apart from each other for long periods of time, just absorbing the sounds, the little tinkle of ice crystals, the creatures that were there, the birds, the seals. And it was a very intense physical feeling. So this one is called Under Erebus. A woman is standing under Erebus. She has wrapped all her gifts around her, including Caritas, a bulky mammal able to feed her young. See the red flag with its purple shadow, the flagged road curving towards tomorrow. There is shelter here, off to the right, a bunch of metal rods and a cloth. You wonder if it's going to be enough. So it's full of terror. And we'd both done heaps and heaps and heaps of reading. And we were aware of the suffering of people who'd gone there in the past.
Yes.
And very often they were buoyed up by romanticism. Amundsen said, it would be great, you know, to be the Prince Charming who would wake Antarctica with a kiss. And you look at his face in the museum and you think, oh, my God, he could be as, you know, romantic as that.
Yes, he looks very stern, doesn't he?
Yes.
There. So this story, yes, you went down having told them that that would be your project. Mm. And obviously for you, lots of poems yes. came out of it and a collection. And for Catherine, it informed the way that she did her work as well. But here we are in 2026 and the book has finally come out. Mm. It's a slender volume. It's spare. It's so evocative of what it must be like to be down there, the silence, the mystery, the terror, as you say. You worked and worked on this text. How did Catherine approach it, do you think?
She had completed all the paintings, I think, by 2007.
So what we're seeing in the book... Mm. Are the paintings that she had done back then?
It might have been a little later than that. Actually, it was a good thing that I wrote thousands and thousands of words, which were this laboriously full Gothic novel, because it gave her tons and tons and tons of images and gave her lots of events and things that she could take into her imagination.
So you were feeding her text at the same time.
I was feeding her text. That's a lovely way to put it, because over the years I've thought, oh, flipping this, flipping that. I'm just a loser with this project. It's terrible. It's driving me insane, you know. And it just required quite a few rejections, because I would be, you would very kindly try to get a grant for us from Creative New Zealand. And it never quite
didn't
matched
fit.
Up. It didn't fit, did it?
No.
It didn't fit.
And I but think it should have fitted.
It could never have fitted, I think, because in my mind and in the work as it stood there, the paintings and the words weren't equal. There were thousands of words. You were reading, turning page after page of words, and then, because I never saw it as a book, then there would have been a painting. And it was always, it intended itself to be an absolutely equal relationship, as was our relationship in going to Antarctica.
Which is what this book is. It's so, they're so married, the text and the illustrations, the paintings. As you say, she paints the way that you think, the way
absolutely.
That you write.
It's astonishing. It's astonishing. And we never have discussed a word. And I have never discussed any of her paintings, except that she had done a series of dark paintings arising from the Antarctic experience. And then she did a series that were lighter, and they had yellows and blues and things and that. But she was very, very good. I just chose all the dark ones because that's my Irish nature.
Yes.
I'm taught that. And lovely Doc Ross, he photographed them all, you know, so they could be printed. And he actually said, I have never understood before the beauty and the danger of Antarctica till he saw those paintings.
Yes, because a lot of the paintings have things lurking,
they do.
Don't they?
They do.
And yeah.
Things that aren't, they've never been in any text.
No.
But there are shadows and sort of
shapes
ghostly
and,
things. And
exactly. And
okay.
Saul herself, she was clear to you from the beginning?
She, when I was in 2004, was my last year teaching. I was at Christchurch Girls High at this stage, and then I got there. Antarctic Fellowship, and so I just got a couple of weeks off school and went down and everything, and this particular class, they said to me, Mrs. Hall, will you please write something about us? And afterwards, you know, I stopped teaching, but I would think about the girls that I taught over all these years, 35 years, who were the vanishing girls. And at that stage, the terrible affliction was anorexia. I remember visiting one girl in hospital. If she sat up, she would die. Her health was so, so fragile. And so that girl, you know, has just been part of my interior life in many ways.
So Saul can't speak, won't speak. She's filled with ice. She needs to thaw, but she needs to go to the ice in order to find a way to reemerge.
It's an incredible description of what I was, you know, what I wasn't trying. I had to do it all just by instinct.
Yeah.
But I turned 80 recently, and my sister came over from Australia, and she said, why did you not talk to us for a year when our father died? And I was 16. I'd come home and he'd crashed and burned in my mother's arms, and I couldn't quite remember that I hadn't spoken to the family. I know I was an odd person at school because there wasn't counselling or anything. I probably wouldn't have said anything now.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Myself.
So you understand what it's like to be withdrawn, to be inarticulate.
Mm.
Yeah.
To be shattered.
Yeah.
And now in my mature, inverted commas, old age, I think it's to also to do is with rage, the
of
anger,
course,
the anger. I would call it anger now. Before I would just say I was very sad, probably. But I think there's a kind of an inexplicable rage that you can't find words for.
Incoherent?
Yeah,
is
it would
that
be.
A word?
I think it would be.
Yeah. So let us say to finish that this, that Saul, you know, there's no spoiler alert here to say that the sunshine comes back into her life and she becomes happy is a strange word, isn't it?
She it's a very strange word.
Content. She becomes part of the world again. And so the paintings pull you back into that. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful book, Bernadette. Oh, I have, you know, I've always been a huge fan of your work and, of course, of Catherine's. Mm-hmm. So it's no surprise to me that it's such an exquisitely crafted piece of work.
Mm. Oh, that's extraordinarily good of you. I think
it's not because I'm
I am
being quite truthful here.
Yeah, no, you're the ideal perfect reader. I think I was really happy by the end that emotions were not just clear cut things. I was really happy that it turned out that Saul had memories which she didn't destroy, but also her life had changed. And she was, because to say, are you happy or are you sad, I don't think that's actually a possibility.
No,
everything is more nuanced, isn't
you're
it?
You're happy and sad. Of course you are. Well, the book is called The Girl Who Was Swallowed by Ice and Snow. It's written by Bernadette Hall with illustrations, paintings by Catherine Medill, and it's published by the Tuirau Arcade. So is it widely available, Bernadette?
Well, at the moment it's available from the City Art Depot, and I think it may be for another week, by which stage the Tuirau Arcade, which is John and me, needs to get its act together and organise how to actually send the book out into the world.
There is a Gmail.
There is a Gmail.
There's the Tuirau Arcade, or one word, at gmail.com. And keep your eye and ear and do your Googling to find out where you might get a copy of this. Thank you, Bernadette.
Thanks so much, Maureen.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM. Streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Elizabeth Knox is one of our best known, widely loved and much awarded novelists. She was made a companion of the New Zealand of Order. She was made a companion of the New Zealand Order of Merit in 2020. She is an Arts Laureate and a recipient of the Prime Minister's Award for Literature. Her latest work is a memoir, Nightmare. It details three tumultuous years in her family's lives that test them all. Elizabeth, despite these events having happened nearly 15 years ago, your having worked on the memoir for at least 10 years, got feedback from and workshopped the book with some of our most notable writers, there's still been significant trepidation over how the work will be received, how your breaking the strange silence will resonate. Why is that?
You mean for me?
For you and your family.
I think a memoir, all memoirs are going to cause trepidation to the person who's written them and to the family. I think the one thing that in the end made me think that this should be okay with how much time I spent writing it and how many times I reviewed what I was doing and adjusted my tone or, you know, cooled things off, took things out, and, of course, put things in that other people said, no, you can't just say that without explaining this. So I think it was just the amount of thinking that had gone into it that made me think this is ready. Whether I was ready is another matter. It's been very well received so far, so I'm feeling a lot more peaceful and calm about it. But yeah, there was certainly a nervous moment putting it out in the world.
Yeah, because you
the pace of it is so unhurried. It's like you're bearing witness to these events, but it's something that, you know, each event has to be thoroughly remembered, but it also needs a lot of unpacking, doesn't it? It needs a lot of backstory.
Well, yes, some events particularly needed backstory. The business of watching my mother become mysteriously ill and beginning to cry, whereas this is a person who didn't cry, and one thing that we could see that she must be distressed about, and she was, but not as distressed as we thought because the crying was a symptom, but was my older sister's mental health and living circumstances. So we were trying to figure out what we could do to alleviate Mum's distress in the first place, and then in the course of doing that, realising just how bad the problem was, and then in the course of trying to do something about the problem, for me, working against how difficult it was for me to try to have, to cross boundaries I'd made with myself, with my sister, in order to not, not be thrown back into the past. And I was thrown back into the past just by exposure to her during the time that we had to figure out how to help.
Yeah. I mean, it's in the book, so it has to be said. Joe had, your older sister, had this serious psychotic breakdown. But, you know, it was years, a lifetime in the making, and your relationship with her as a small child had been really extraordinarily difficult for you because of the abuse that you suffered at her hands, the sexual abuse, but also a psychological sort of abuse in a way too.
When it comes to her as company, the company of an older child, that was definitely mixed, in that she was quite dangerous, and I wouldn't say disconcerting. My adult self looks back and goes disconcerting, but at the time it's just your reality, particularly if you're left alone in her company as much as I was. She could make the world enchanted with her imagination, but on the other hand, she was fearless and experimental and had very little empathy, very little understanding of why another person was afraid or distressed. In fact, I think she was kind of interested in it, like she'd see it in others, and particularly in her younger sister, who was always around her, and she'd just sort of kind of, you know, try to make it happen.
Yes.
she didn't understand it. I kept feeling that she was watching in order to see something she couldn't experience herself.
Mm.
So in that way, she was very, very tricky. And the sexual abuse was the thing that was terribly damaging because of the secrecy involved and the shame and the manipulation and in the end just the damage to my ability to trust was huge. So yeah. And when you're young, you think you're going to walk away from it all.
Mm.
You think you're going to, that happened in my past and I'll walk away, but you become older, you become a parent, you get a better idea of how the world should work and how children should be protected, and the things that are distressing are more distressing.
Of course. And you know, as you say, dealing with your mother's decline into motor neuron disease, having Joe have this, you know, serious breakdown where she has to be put into hospital and taken care of, this extreme pressure on all of you in the family to deal with the day-to-day things. For you, writing it down and, you know, as I said before, bearing witness to it, that must have been some way of dealing with it, of making sense of it.
Yeah, I was trying to, but for a long time it felt that I was just kind of, as they say, re-traumatising myself. So doing the memory work, going back into the past and remembering what you could, and then pressing on the memories until you know, you go, oh, that's right. Or, there were certainly occasions where I could, when it came to my childhood, I could ask my younger sister, and she had some very enlightening views on, and that expanded my memories of certain incidents, because she was there too, getting, you know, the punishment for telling tales on us that was that she was subjected to. Mm. It was hard to write, but mostly it was hard to write because I kept feeling that I hadn't got it right. Like, and I kept trying to think I could dodge writing about certain things, and then it just never felt true until I wrote everything that needed to be in it.
Yeah, I imagine you just had to keep going back. You say at one stage that you mustn't confuse honesty with truth when you're writing a memoir.
Oh, yeah. I just feel that that's true in life. There's a line that goes about people who hurt other people's feelings because they're, you know, faultlessly honest for one reason or another, that they're just honest, you know, that they're just, and then people say they're just telling the truth, but actually, no, they're saying what they think is true, whereas what's true is, beyond that. So yeah. The thing is with a memoir is that you're always going to be subjective, because it is a memoir, because it has a point of view, which is the person who's writing it. But you have to try as hard as possible to make sure that the memoir tells you it's being subjective, and in yourself you're practicing, I call it considered subjectivity, that you think really, really hard about what you're doing. And, you know, think really, really hard about what's true. But while you're also saying, this is what I remember, this is what I think now, and all those things that you can say to constantly remind the reader that you have a point of view and that you're giving your point of view.
Yeah, hard work. your description of your mother, of the time you spent with her, the endless trips back and forth to Picton to be with her, that's such a warm and wonderful part of this memoir, because you want to honour who she was rather than just concentrating on what the disease did to her.
Yes. Mum was a person, Heather Knox, my mother, our mother, was a person who a lot of people admired. I mean, she lived a quiet life, so she was known to as many people as people who live quiet lives are known to. And people admired her because she had these, she was very lively, she was very interested in people. And it wasn't politeness, it was, never transactional. It was just this genuine fascination with other human beings, what they did, why they did them. And, and people responded to that. And they'd confide in her. And, and she wasn't exactly a warm person, but her interest was warm. But she was very no nonsense, you know. She didn't suffer fools, but she wasn't a person who would say she didn't suffer fools, because she was always entertained by fools.
Yeah, of course.
So she didn't suffer the unkind or rude ones. So she had an enormous amount of charm, and so I was just trying to capture that.
You did?
Yeah.
And you said something about how the conversations you had about her interest in people is partly why you think you became a novelist, because...
Yeah, I think she just trained my thinking. Like, we would just have conversations about people. And, it was good training. She was a good psychologist.
Yes. Yeah. Often people who are observant and like, you know, working those kind of things out are very good psychologists. Your writing, it's very consistent, obviously, but when you're describing, the details of the third terrible thing that happened, the senseless death of Fergus's brother over in the Cook Islands, and the dreadful sorrow that followed, and you're going over to be there with the family for the trial. Your writing changes a little there, I feel. Like,
yes, well, I'm a different distance as a storyteller from the events, because I'm there, but what I was doing when I was trying to figure out how to handle my older sister's psychotic break and dealing with my mother's motor neuron disease, I was right there going, this falls mostly on me and I have to figure it out. I was standing behind Fergus, watching him and supporting him with what happened to Duncan. So I had a slightly different relation to the events. So I kind of changed tone during those chapters, and that took me a while to work out how to change tone. And the fact that the story mostly appears in two chapters, one around the time of his death and his funeral, and then over a year later when there's a trial in Rarotonga and we go over there. And because I had to figure out how to write the trial, and I had sat in the courtroom for the entirety of the prosecution's case, apart from the coroner's report, before I had to go home to sub in for Fergus on a book launch and do various other things. I'd recorded things on my iPhone, planning to just have it so that I could talk to his kids one day when they were grown up enough to hear a fuller story. So that's why I recorded it. But then when I came to write about it, it was very useful because I had the testimony. I didn't have to go and get the trial transcript, because, in effect, I had the trial transcript with all the beautiful noises off, like, shuffling in courtrooms and the fans balanced on seats because the air conditioning wasn't working, and all that stuff was there reminding me. But when I decided to write, because we never heard until the trial what had happened that night. We just didn't have an account of it. No one told us. And so when we sat there, we found out in detail what happened. And so I wrote it like that. I went into an eye of God and I used the testimony to build a picture of what was happening chronologically, really. So I moved from groups of people around and just made a picture of the night. And that's interspersed with little bits of courtroom and little bits of we're in Rarotonga and we go to a church service, or we're in Rarotonga and we're swimming at night in the swimming pool. You know, just the sort of, bodies and space and time stuff.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that you've somehow written, well, not somehow because I know how much work and time you've put into it. It's not somehow. But you have written a piece of work that is incredibly absorbing.
Thank you.
And, you know, so well considered, so beautifully written. I can't think of anybody who reads it that won't be hugely moved by it and come out, you know, a different person in a way. So thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you. My aim the whole time with the whole book was just, I had these experiences and I wanted to make people as much as possible feel what I felt at the time I was having them or witnessing the things I witnessed. It was just like, I will try to make people feel what I felt. And then you add the thinking.
Yeah. Well, you
that was kind of my recipe.
perfectly baked, Elizabeth. The book is called Nightmare. It's a memoir. It's by Elizabeth Knox and it's published by Te Heringa Waka Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
The sportsman drops a goal. Surprising everybody and almost himself, he spun on his heel and swung savagely at the small bladder, which he knew with certainty comprised parts of pig. And with a swift boot made up, he knew with equal certainty, from parts of calf, he lifted the ex-pig high into the sky and sent it zinging between two posts of ex-tree. Whereupon the terraces erupted with brays, bleats, and exultant whinnies, and waved bits of sheep about in the colourful air.
That was James Norcliffe reading from his latest collection of poems. It's entitled A Day Like No Other, and it is selected poems from the various collections he's published in a long and very distinguished career. He was awarded the Prime Minister's Award for Literary Achievement in Poetry in 2022, but he is not just a poet. He is a children's author, a young adult author, and a much-loved mentor and former teacher. James, is also known as Jim, has just turned 80, and he's wincing at the thought. And what I love about that particular poem, it's from, I think, the earliest
That's from the earliest book. It was called The Sportsman, and it starts with a sequence of sportsman poems, and they're fairly cynical, I must say. The book came out in the 80s, not long after the World Rugby Cup was held in New Zealand. I was still feeling very jaundiced and cynical about rugby, given what had happened in 1981. So the poems are satirical, but also quite funny. So they're not angry poems.
No. you deal with anger in your own particular way, because there's plenty of poems in this whole selection that are very pointed poems, humour and cynicism and, and satire in particular, they come to you more readily than sort of writing hot words on the page.
I had to sort of confront that aspect when Otago, a couple of books ago, published a volume called Deadpan. And Sue Wharton, the publisher, suggested I write an essay explaining where the deadpan in my poetry, the deadpan aspect, came from. And they did a lovely job with a book with a picture of the exemplar of deadpan, Buster Keaton, on the cover. And I found when I was writing that essay that it probably comes, this sort of deadpan humour, wry, ironical humour, probably comes through my family, because on my father's side is very Yorkshire, and the Yorkshire wit is a bit like that. And on my mother's side, I've got the Scottish aspect, and they're a bit like that as well. So I was probably born to be ironic and not direct and sort of unemotional at expressing things in a way that is apparent to the reader if they think a bit about it.
Eric Kennedy has written a wonderful foreword to this collection, and he uses the word unsentimental. And I think that's very apt, because it's nothing saccharine in your poems.
No, and that's a bit odd, because I am hopelessly sentimental as a person. I mean, and I move to tears very easily. My mother was utterly labile. You just have to say mother to her and she'd think of her own mother and burst into tears. It doesn't happen with me that way, but I do remember as a kid, and as you say, I'm 80, the family sometimes would go down to see somebody off on the ferry at Littleton, the ferry to Wellington. And the ferry's departure was always marked by excitement on the wharf and streamers. And at some point, the whole crowd would sing, "Now is the hour." And even though I hardly knew the people sailing away, I'd still feel moved almost to tears by that ship sailing out with all those people and the streamers floating in the wind. So, yeah, but in the poetry, I don't like sentimentality. I don't like greeting card type verse and that sort of thing. So I hope to, perhaps I fight against it, I suppose.
Well, there's never. That's a sort of beginning of a song, isn't it? there's never any shortage of targets to aim at.
No. And especially in this day and age. And you don't really want to be too direct. Occasionally, I think perhaps the most powerful poem a political poem I've written, is called a poem called The Attack on Baghdad, and because I was really upset about that war in Iraq, but I wrote the whole poem is a metaphor. It doesn't mention Baghdad at all. And interestingly, when Newsroom published one of my poems from the book, Steve Brownie chose that poem to represent the work I do.
It's a very spare poem, yeah. As you say.
It's quite brief. Perhaps I should read it.
Yeah, I think you should.
You keep talking while I find it.
Okay. Let me fill in about Jim. Jim is a great reader of his own poems. I can certainly say that. You're a stalwart of the Canterbury Poets Collective, which is a very active group of poets. And I've been there many times and heard you read. And I always think it's such a joy to hear poets read their own work.
Yes, and I must put in a plug for the Canterbury Poets Collective, because they do a marvellous job, and they have brought through poets who, on their first outing, seem to be nervous and worried and unconfident. And as they come along the next night and the next night and the next season, you see them growing in confidence and and the pure pleasure of reading to an audience. And that's the big, that's the good thing, I think, when you get to the point where you actually look forward to reading your work. Here's that poem anyway. It's called The Attack on Baghdad. In the evening, a rising wind knocked the black peaches from the laden branches. One by one they dropped, and some fell into the roses where thorns tore at their flesh. And some fell onto the bank and rolled down toward the river, gathering dust and bruises. The dark sand was stained black with peach blood, and when wasps arrived and were excited, the air crackled with their lust.
So, I think, well, I can only wonder at what Steve Brawnius saw in that poem, not because it isn't a great poem, but I suspect what he was, what drew him to it was what's going on currently.
Oh, I guess so. That occurred to me too, I'm sure.
Yeah. Because it's a poem that is so universal in its condemnation of violence.
And it's set in the neighbourhood. So.
Yes, indeed.
But you mentioned anger before. That is probably the angriest poem I've written as well.
It's very contained anger, but it's powerful because it's contained, I think. Mm. So that is what you do in your poems. They're very, very well controlled, but with a light touch.
Yes. And that's one of the reasons I was so delighted when Sue suggested we could put a book together of selected poems. Yes, I thought for a while it might have been collected, and I sent her about 5,000 poems. But she said, "Eyes bigger than your tummy, James."
So, yes, exactly. Yeah. And selected is the apt description.
Yeah.
Tell me about the process of going back. I mean, I'm not harping on how old you are because, you know, that is subjective. But
it was a fascination because I pulled out books that I hadn't, because I'm not a great rereader of my book, you know. I don't like looking in the mirror too much. I don't like looking too much in the mirror because I expect to see George Clooney there, but
yes.
He never is. And I certainly don't go too much. Once the book's out and no longer current, I don't read from it anymore unless there's a specific reason. So a lot of the books I hadn't really read from cover to cover for a long time. And choosing... And as I say, my eyes were bigger than my tummy. Joe and my wife and I were the selecting editors at the first bite, and we chose everything we really, really wanted in the book. Of course, that wasn't ever going to be possible. So the book then became more of a distillation, because, as you say, there are 10 or 11 books there. And we only a few poems from each book, so they had to be chosen with a few criteria in mind. And one was they had to be poems we really, really loved and liked. We wanted them to reflect the range of the things I do, because I'm quite an eclectic poet, both in form and in tone and in subject matter. We wanted to choose a few crowd favourites, you know, the ones that I often asked to read, and the ones that perhaps best demonstrate what I do, and so that was able. We were able to cut out about 5% by doing that.
Yes.
So it was a great process, and Sue came in finally with the shears and cut through all the longer one.
Yes, you probably needed that to happen at some stage.
Well, one thing I do is tend to write in long sequences. you know, up to 10 pages. So I'm with Edgar Allan Poe. I don't think there is any such thing as a long poem. I think a poem should best fit in a page or a page and a half. But the sequence allows me to write a series of short poems and pretend it's a long poem. But they do, the bits do tend to depend on each other. So all the sequences were out, really, including some I really wanted in. And that cut it down a lot. But I'm really, really happy with what we've got. I can look through the book and say, oh, I shouldn't have included that. As you do with, you know, a new book, you go through, oops, I shouldn't, that was a mistake. But this book, yep. I feel everything has earned its place in the book. And, yeah, for those reasons I mentioned.
Jim, would you like to close with well, how do you choose? but I'm sure that you will use your judicious eye to, and you will have a thought about what's a good closing poem from a selection like this.
Well, I'll read a poem which I think Eric mentioned somewhere has become one of my crowd favourites, because it's a poem basically addressed to writers, and one of the things I've come to do is write a lot more prosy sort of poems. I work with Michelle Alvey on Flash Fiction in a magazine, and I've come to land on the poetic end of Flash Fiction, of what we used to call a prose poem, and also recontextualizing language which is used in another situation. That's fun, so this is fun. So this is a poem really addressed to all those writers who send stuff off to hard-hearted editors. Dear contributor, spruce is a member of the Picea family. It is a coniferous evergreen from the northern temperature and boreal regions of the earth. Pine trees are also conifers, also evergreen, and comprise members of the very large Pinus family. Larch is another conifer of the genus Larix from the boreal regions of the earth. It differs from the aforementioned in that it is deciduous. Hemlock is yet another conifer, a member of the Suga family found in North America and parts of Asia. It is not to be confused with the herb hemlock, a decoction of which was used to put Socrates to death. The above are all useful and beautiful trees, none of which we are prepared to sacrifice in order to publish your contribution. Sincerely, the editors.
Do you know which tree was sacrificed for this collection, selection?
I don't know. This book was actually published in Malaysia and they did a beautiful job. So I hope it wasn't a rainforest.
No, exactly. One of the trees that we are trying to save.
Exactly.
Well, I am glad that many conifers of whatever genus or family have been cut down and pulped in order to publish your poems, Jim.
Thank you.
Congratulations on this selection. It's called A Day Like No Other. It is by the renowned James Norcliffe, and it's published by Otago University Press. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.